Welcome back to the Age of Awareness podcast with your host, Sean Fallon and Stephen Musket. We have a really interesting conversation today about school lunches with author and professor Marcus Weaver Hightower. And it's especially relevant today with things like the federal lunch program with that ending last year it was the federal funding that made possible free lunches for all public schools. We also have Minnesota and New Mexico joining the ranks with, I believe, five or six other states that provide free lunches for all their students, no matter what the income is. So I think it's especially relevant today, and I hope you enjoy.
I'm curious, how did you get onto this topic? Like, how did school lunches even become a thing for you?
Yeah, you know, I mean, it actually started a little bit as, I mean, there's always when people do research, part of it is they're trying to research their own anxieties, right? And one of the things that, you know, always came up for me in my life has been food. You know, I mean, not only kind of a love of food that I came to from, you know, my family, a good Southern family that loved to eat and, you know, trying to maintain my own weight, but also all these kinds of experiences that I had as a student and also as a teacher, where, you know, school lunch was a fraught kind of time in the school day, right? I mean, like, not only like, are you eating the right things, you know, or if your mom packs you stuff, is she using the right peanut butter? You know, like the kinds of friendships and social relationships that go on in the lunchroom. It's a time of day within the school day that is so different, but so important to so many kids, right? I mean, like, if you ask them what happened during the day, and I ask my own kids this every day, you know, lunch is almost always going to have a story to it. So it's such an interesting but relatively rarely thought about kind of part of the school day, as you mentioned earlier. And, you know, I thought to myself, okay, well, let's think about it. Like, what is going on in the school lunchroom? I really got a little bit more into the politics of it because I, you know, studied sort of critical political perspectives around school issues as a graduate student. And it was one of those things that came up like, hey, this is important. This is one way that we can either really help students or really hurt students. And, you know, we should think about it a little bit more seriously and really put some nuanced thought into it.
So you used a crucial word there, the politics. And, you know, whenever there's a lot of money flowing in different directions, there's always some sort of political angle. So can you shed a little light on the system itself? You know, just paint a picture of just how big the school lunch system is and who some of the players might be. And then when you say politics, I mean, what do you really mean by that?
Well, it's interesting. When I talk about politics, I do mean sort of the standard, like, voting politics. We're recording this the day after a midterm election, right? And so there are people who have been thinking about this issue as a sort of, you know, should I vote for this person or not? Should I vote for this ballot initiative or not in terms of politics? But there's also kind of, there's politics on multiple ends, right? There's the local politics of school food, because each state is running their own school lunch programs, and they can make a lot of decisions about, you know, what kids are going to be eating. There's a federal level politics, because the federal government, it puts a lot of money into it, and the kinds of decisions that are made can affect a lot of what students can eat, and, you know, the people who work in cafeterias. There's also a sort of transnational politics that goes on. So folks like ADM, who are major players in worldwide food distribution. There's contractors who can do school food, like Sodexo and Aramark. These are, you know, multinational corporations. So there are so many levels. As you mentioned, it's like a $15 billion a year industry. and you've got everybody from farmers to cafeteria workers to local politicians to federal politicians to, you know, companies that we can't even sort of have any kind of democratic control over, having their hand in what kids eat. And it, you know, it ranges from everything to kind of little technical issues like what gets to count as a vegetable. Right. So you may have heard a phrase like, you know, during the Reagan administration, the ketchup as a vegetable phrase kind of came out. It stuck with him. It was even in his obituary, you know, that that whole affair really kind of tainted his presidency to a great degree. But, you know, even more recently, back in, I think it was 2014, you know, Congress basically decided, OK, well, pizza is a vegetable, too, because it's got the 2 tablespoons of pizza sauce on it. Right. So there are fights over very basic things like, well, what gets to count as a vegetable? What counts as water? What counts as, you know, welfare, fairness, all sorts of things are being defined when we're trying to define what school food is. And then, of course, you know, funding is always a political battle. You know, should we make it only for kids who really can't afford anything? Should we make it universally free? So there's so many questions that come up in these kinds of debates, and there's so many facets of this that we can look at that it really, I think it's fascinating. That's what I mean by politics is every decision, right? And there's millions of them that affect what kids and teachers eat on a daily basis.
I have to imagine there are probably some examples that really illustrate, you know, the research that you've been doing that people may not realize is something that could have such an impact. A true did you realize moment that because somebody decided this around this policy that now that. So is there anything that comes to mind for you in terms of just examples that really illustrate the complexity or the kind of the unseen impact of school lunch?
Well, there's many, many, many. And I would say that, you know, one of the things that I think people don't realize is that the food system that goes on outside of what's happening in cafeterias is a really complex part of what kids are going to get to eat. So for instance, the large professional organization for nutritionists and cafeteria workers in the United States is called the School Nutrition Association. This is, you know, an organization that makes, you know, tens of millions of dollars a year, not only representing the folks who are working in cafeterias and school districts, but they're also representing the industry. So I went to one of their conferences. I very affectionately call it the Lunch Lady Conference. And I went in when they were in Las Vegas, and you go into this exhibit hall for all these lunch professionals, and they have just the most amazing amount of swag, merchandise. You know, they're trying to ply every sort of, you know, lunchroom concoction they can, right? Whatever little pizza rolls or whatever they've invented. And just, you just get overwhelmed by the amount of money and influence that actually the people who are, you know, in the industry, who are selling things to school lunch programs over the kinds of things that kids will eat. And the kinds of things that they want to sell are the things that, of course, are very profitable. So things that they know kids are going to want to actually consume. So carnival fare food is what it's often called, right? The latest engineered corn dog or the latest engineered pizza, whatever, and, you know, loaded French fries and breakfast. Don't get me started about breakfast. The amount of sugar and carbohydrates in national school breakfast program is insane. But it's really so much of the way we structure policies is fit for the industry members, right? I mean, they, you know, it helps them to have things like 2 tablespoons of pizza sauce as a vegetable because they can then package it and say, okay, here, lunch lady who doesn't have time or training to really be a chef, you know, here's what it counts as in terms of these kinds of nutritional things. Salt levels, when they tried to reduce sodium levels in school lunches within the Obama administration, this became a really big issue because obviously sodium helps keep things fresh and it tastes better and all the kinds of issues that, you know, the industry wants to keep in place. So they've had a really much bigger impact than most people realize, I think.
As you were describing that, what came to mind for me was like the military industrial complex. And this is the school lunch industrial complex, you know, and there's a sort of a parallel of sorts. I was also thinking too, I know this is like, it seems like once a year, you know, once every 2 years, an article goes viral about school lunches around the world and its pictures of a school lunch in Finland or Norway or in Japan or South America. And then, of course, there's the classic American school lunch with, hard to identify chicken sandwich or whatever they call it. And I guess what that tells me is that it is possible to get fresh food or healthy food at scale. And so, you know, it can happen here. It could happen here. But from your perspective, what needs to change, or what are some of the changes that you think this system needs to adopt in order to improve the school lunch experience?
Well, and that's such an excellent question. And I will say, to give credit where it's due, that there are lots and lots of folks around the United States who don't sort of subscribe to that, carnival fair kind of system of feeding kids. There are lots and lots of folks in lots and lots of places who are trying out innovative ideas, things like scratch cooking. That's been much more problematic to do scratch cooking because, you know, they don't offer as much training. It's safer, I think, for school districts to buy things that have been packaged at a factory. So if something goes wrong in terms of food safety, they don't have to worry about it. The amount of time and, you know, resources that they have to put into it is difficult. So, you know, but there are a lot of folks out there who are doing these innovative things, like creating farm to school programs. Doug Davis in Vermont, Burlington, Vermont, has been a real innovator in trying to get, you know, fresh things into the schools from the local community. There's folks like Alice Waters in Berkeley, California, who sort of set up a school garden kind of a setup and has kind of transported that all around the country. And so there's lots of people who have the kind of edible schoolyard, school garden kind of concept going on. And those are some things that I think are really, really positive. I think it's difficult to do some of those things at scale. And that's where a lot of times it becomes problematic. Local vegetable programs can't necessarily keep up with, you know, a cafeteria that's serving 1,000 meals a day. It's just, you know, we don't have, you know, local farms often in many, many places that can keep up with that. But there are lots of things that we can do and have done that have been truly successful. Things like universally free school lunches. We saw this during the pandemic. This has made a tremendous difference in kids being able to eat, to do so without the kind of lunch shaming that has happened for a lot of kids. Trying to avoid school debt, or excuse me, lunch debt for parents. These have been successful ways to get more food to more kids. But I'll also say that, you know, when the Obama administration put forth the Healthy Hunger-Free Kids Act in 2010, they made some tweaks to the nutritional standards that we have for school lunches that have made a real difference. So the Journal of American Medical Association, I think last year or maybe 2 years ago, came out with a study that showed that school lunches are actually healthier than food you can get in restaurants and even in grocery stores. So, you know, we've made big differences for kids already with just a little bit more funding, some tighter standards that try to go along with the kinds of things that, you know, medical professionals and nutritional professionals say are good moves. That's been somewhat incremental, but, you know, it's been effective at the policy level. And then all those, you know, thousands and thousands of folks out there who are, you know, doing innovations in cafeterias every day are a way to improve things for kids.
I was thinking a little bit as you were talking about some of these programs that are very local, you know, the farm to school concept or local gardening. And, it took me back to watching, and I know this is almost cliche to say, oh, Michael Pollan, you know, I know he's a well-worn name, and some people love him, some people hate him, but, I remember watching, you know, I read his books, but then I also watched, that series he had on Netflix, Cooked. And one of the things that struck me about watching that was the case he made for the human connection between preparing food and just really how that process can create a more human experience. And with the absence of that, that we're noticing, or we're seeing a loss of tradition, a loss of cultural ingredients that have been passed on for generations, but are not making it to the next generation because we consume food differently. And as I was sort of having this thought, as you were describing, you know, these programs, it also brings to mind what you said about the school cafeteria being a very important location, both in terms of a physical space within the school, but also in terms of how it fits inside of a student's day and even really their social development. So I'm curious if your research or your work has led you to any conclusions about, or at least some wonderings about, you know, the impacts of just the cafeteria on the student experience itself.
Oh, absolutely. And, you know, you mentioned earlier about the kind of that journalism thing, that trope of like looking at other countries in terms of like the, you know, the different types of food, but there's also different experiences of the cafeteria in other countries that I think it can be really instructive, right? What does it say about American society that we try to get kids through as quickly as possible? Some students actually get, you know, 15 minutes to eat. How are they going to have, you know, rich conversations with their peers and really enjoy their food? We tend too often to use it as a kind of utilitarian kind of thing. Well, kids have to eat because they're at school for a long school day. But what if we thought differently about it and didn't make it a kind of fast food experience where not only the decor and the time that you are given to eat and the actual food that you're given to eat, what if it was something that was more, you know, that was a little bit slower experience, where you got to eat with actual silverware instead of plastic sporks, where you got to, you know, really talk with other people, where maybe teachers were involved in helping eat, you know, and that kind of dynamic cultural sort of sphere that food can be for people, instead of this kind of very fast foody sort of approach. I think it's really quite important to begin to really reconsider how food is presented and how it's consumed. And many other countries do it differently. You know, there's in Sweden, for instance, they have what they call the pedagogical school meal, right? Where you think of the school cafeteria not as like a break to, you know, just fill up your belly as fast as you can, but you think about it as an opportunity to really learn things about food and culture and eating and, you know, the kind of sort of social interaction that you can get with other students and teachers. And many, many other cultures do it that way rather than just, you know, the kids get shoved in there. They're monitored closely so that they don't misbehave and, you know, those kinds of things.
Was there a moment for you where it all clicked? I know we talked a little bit early on in the conversation about how you landed on school lunches, but you know, we're always curious about these moments in time where somebody, you know, we've had guests before describe, you know, I was sitting on a subway train and reflecting on an experience I had in the classroom with a particular student, and it just hit me like a bolt of lightning and sent me off in a particular direction. So you were curious, was there a moment in time where it all came together, a gestalt or a click around the work that you're doing now?
Oh, I wish I could say that, yes, there was the one moment, the lightning bolt from the heavens that, you know, made it all happen for me. But there's so many dimensions to the school lunch program that I think I've had kind of hundreds of those. I think really for me, it took a while to realize the kind of racial politics that we have in school lunches. So learning about not only the history of the creation of the school lunch program, which, you know, part of the reason it's state by state is because when it was created, you know, it was the 1940s and race and segregation was a huge issue for especially Southern states. So the folks that put it together thought, well, if we make this a federal only program, you know, it's going to be used as a wedge to end segregation. And other kinds of things have happened along the way in the school lunch program. And I think especially this sort of drift towards thinking of it as a welfare program that especially happened in the 1980s, you know, it kind of uncovers that sort of racialized element that people don't often think about. Things like, you know, going to that lunch lady conference, that was a bolt of lightning for me about like this, you know, I kind of just sort of assume like most people that this is almost like charity for food companies to like, you know, serve whatever sort of remainders they may have to school lunches. But no, they want this business super bad because they can get a lot of money off of the stability of this particular program, because that's another aspect of this, is it's a very stable program. The demand doesn't necessarily go up and down in huge ways. So if you can, you know, get your foot in the door in a lot of districts, especially the larger districts, you know, New York, Los Angeles, those kinds of school districts, you can make a good amount of money off of even what we think of as relatively inexpensive food. So, yeah, I mean, there's so many moments along the way where, you know, I just would be part of something that opened up a whole, you know, new understanding of school lunch and it keeps happening. It's really quite interesting. You know, the pandemic popped up and suddenly school lunch became like a huge major issue in the sort of national news and as part of our national strategy for making sure that families didn't starve. You know, school lunch was part of that. So that was illuminating in a lot of ways, even though I'd been already, you know, thinking about it for almost 15 years.
Yeah, I think Stephen was telling me a story about a PTA meeting where, you know, they were talking about an increase in the price of lunch, which was, you know, I think it totaled $100 or $150 a month. And that for some, a non-issue, but for other families, that's a significant amount of money. And then especially too, if you have multiple kids in the system, that say, you know, it's $100, you know, or $150 for one kid. But if you've got three kids, you got to come up with, some extra cash that, you know, where does it come from? That in some cases could be a meaningful increase in income. You know, for a family. So, are you finding, you know, are you finding anything along those lines in terms of pricing for school lunches and how, you know, impacts or considerations around how school lunches are priced?
Yeah. I mean, this is something that folks have talked about for actually a long, long time. And part of what was so devastating about Ronald Reagan's attempts to cut back on school lunches was that, you know, at the same time that they wanted to take away some of the subsidies and make school lunches a little bit more expensive, and even for like the reduced price lunches, and but also then requiring more paperwork to be able to get free and reduced price lunches, the program basically lost a quarter of its students, which, you know, I think if you're looking only at a fiscal kind of loss, you're thinking, oh, well, you know, that's a lot. But in terms of the human cost, right, that's millions and millions of students not eating lunch because they suddenly can't afford it, or their parents can't fill out the paperwork, or whatever it happens to be. And we know from research that even, you know, a raise in price of just 5 cents will actually kick some kids out of the program. Part of that, of course, is because we've kind of done this tripartite system of, you know, paying for school lunches. We've got free lunches, we've got reduced price lunches, and then full price lunches. And, you know, that reduced price category really can be a major financial hit for people who are right at the cutoff point, because these cutoff points are really quite strict. So, you know, even $100 more that your family earns in a month, if you suddenly, you know, are going to have to pay even, you know, $2 a week for school lunches times 4 weeks, you know, that's $8. Suddenly, you know, your family has only got $92 more than the cutoff. And that's not enough really to make a huge difference in your lifestyle, right? So why do we have this reduced price category? We tend to cling to this reduced price category. In fact, post-pandemic, as Democrats were trying to get more universally free school lunches, basically Rand Paul, from the senator from Kentucky, you know, he was the one holdout that sort of made us have to go back to the reduced price category again. And we know that it's really a horrible kind of financial result for a lot of folks. Of course, you know, schools are also struggling right now with the same kinds of inflationary forces and supply chain issues that, you know, everybody else in the country is facing. So their prices keep going up. You know, how do they respond to that? I mean, you know, some price increases, you think to yourself, well, you got to do it, but you know, and school professionals, nutrition professionals know also that when they make those kind of tough decisions, that it's going to kick some kids out.
Yeah. Well, Marcus, we've covered a lot of ground. If there were one thing from what we've talked about or what we even haven't covered, because I know it's far more complicated and complex than can be revealed in a brief conversation. So if there were one thing that you would want the audience to just keep with them, something they could do or something to remember the next time they do so, you know, just what's that one thing that you'd like everybody to just have at the top of their mind?
Well, I'll sort of make it a two-part answer. I'll say that the biggest thing I think people misunderstand about the school lunch program at this point is that it is not a welfare program. There are a lot of kids who eat school lunches for free, and for them, it's a massive help to keep them out of poverty, to keep them out of food insecurity, those kinds of things. The program was never really intended to be a welfare program. It doesn't function totally as one now. So if you have kids and you can afford to, have them eat lunch. It's really good food, right? It's nutritious food. Sometimes it's not cooked so great and not presented great. I get it. I really do understand that. But, you know, work with the folks who are in your school nutrition program to improve some of those things. And so the second part of this notion of it's, you know, that it's not welfare is that it really, really needs to be universally free for all students. We've just had this sort of unfortunate situation of the pandemic where every kid in the country got free, universally free school lunches. And it's been really successful. So many of the administrative burdens of the program kind of went away, right? Things like parents getting into debt over unpaid school lunch bills, the kinds of shaming that kids get put through because their parents are behind on payments, the paperwork burdens, right? It always sends me into sort of philosophical wonderings about why we treat food so differently from everything else that's going on in schools, right? I mean, can you imagine a politician getting up in front of an audience and saying, we can't have these textbooks be free or these kids are going to get dependent on, you know, the state for their textbooks? I mean, you know, would we say that about getting a bus ride to school? Would we say that about, you know, like if everybody had to put a $5 bill on the teacher's desk in the morning, right? I mean, it always confuses me. Why is it that we treat food differently? And I think some of the conclusion that I've come to is there's a sort of moralistic idea that we have about food being given to people. But these are kids, right? These are, you know, the youth of our nation. We want them to be healthy. We want them to have, you know, enough nutrition. We don't want them to feel shame when they come to school. We want them to learn about culture and food. And, you know, what's the downside other than, you know, it's going to, you know, require just a little bit more funding to go into the school meals to make it free for everybody. And if there's anything that you could do to try to impress upon your leaders, both at a local level, at a state level, and at the federal level, to say, look, let's just give kids a free meal at school, right? We wouldn't charge them for, you know, getting into the bathroom stall. We wouldn't charge them for, again, using textbooks or buses or any of those kinds of things. So, you know, why put a barrier in the school day?
Yeah, thank you, Marcus. If folks are interested in your work and wanna engage with you or read more about what we've talked about here, where can they find you? What options do they have?
Well, I have a wonderful book that just came out this very year called Unpacking School Lunch: The Understanding the Hidden Politics of School Food. So those politics are well hidden, but you'll I think hopefully get an insight into it if you get that book. I've done some other work that you can find online, but you can also feel free to contact me. I'm a professor at Virginia Tech, and so mwh@vt.edu. Feel free to get in touch. I'm always happy to talk school lunch with folks.
Great, thank you. Cool. That was awesome, Marcus. Thank you so much. And you just reminded me, I've neglected to mention that I am also a Hokie.
Are you? Okay. Awesome.
Yeah. I don't know why I didn't mention that up front.
All right. Thank you for tuning in to another episode. We hope to have our next episode out within the coming weeks. Fingers crossed. It can be a little time consuming with editing and scheduling this conversation, so thank you for your patience, and we really appreciate your support. We're now listened to in about 80 countries around the globe, so that's pretty exciting. We really, really appreciate the support, and we hope you tune in next time.